Hello, folks, and welcome to the Metallica Report. I'm Stefan Shirazi, editor of the band So What magazine.
And I'm Renee Richardson, director of philanthropy for Metallica's foundation, All Within My Hands. This is your official weekly Metallica podcast, the only inside source, bringing you all the news from the band's HQ and studios deep in the heart of Northern California. And Steph, I have to bring something up to you.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of saw this little question floating out there. I don't know where I was scrolling and I saw a fan bring this up. And I said, wait a minute. We haven't followed up with Steph about his New Year's resolution. Mm. You made the claim that you were going to learn some riffs on the guitar.
I did.
One of them was Battery. What was the other song you said?
Well, you've written it down as Fight Fire with Fire. I think you've been keeping this in your back pocket for a couple of months. I think you know full well. It's like, oh, I just came across. I just remembered we haven't.
So you're saying I'm full of shit?
No. I think that you're a very, very clever operator. And I admire your skill set here. This is good because you're now about to say, how are you getting on nailing those rhythms?
Exactly.
Right? Is that what you're going to say?
That is exactly what I'm going to say. Have you nailed those riffs, my friend?
I've nailed the intention to learn them. I mean, as you will have heard during episode one of the Greg Fiddleman chat, I'm furiously fretting away here. Unfortunately, with regards to my promise, it was still on an air guitar and not on an actual guitar. I do have intent, and I have to say, I was hanging out with HQ yesterday. Zach Harmon was there, and I was looking at Zach. I'm thinking, we're going to go on tour soon. You know, maybe I can get one of these guys to kind of help guide me through. Tour's the time. Tour's going to be the time I can maybe get someone to sit down for 5 minutes. Now, talk about assumptions. I mean, assuming that anyone's going to want to sit down with this numpty and teach them how to play these riffs. But I have faith and I have given my word.
All right.
To our pod listeners and to you. And now that I know that you're on full police watch, I better step up.
You better.
Short answer is no, I need to step up. But I like the flowery way of saying it. So
yeah. Did we set a date for you on this?
If you have a date in mind, would you like to state it?
Yes. By the end of the European leg of the tour.
By the end of the European leg? No. Can I plead for clemency and say by the time the band enter Mexico?
All right. I'll give
you
that.
Is that all right? Can I do that?
That's all right. Yeah. And I know everybody's been looking forward to get to part two of our conversation with Metallica's producer and trusted set of ears, Mr. Greg Fiddleman. But before we get into it, I did want to let you know that we have these curated weekly playlists as a companion to each episode. And Steph has been the driving force behind Music from the Metallica Report, which you can find on Spotify. Now, I take no credit for this, but I love reaping the rewards of just a little peek into the window of Steph's mind. I love your playlists, my friend. They're great.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and it is a peek into my mind for sure, but I'm also trying to flow decades of music that's been flowing in and around the, you know, our ecosystem here and take that into account, as well as, you know, hopefully nail a few tunes that are directly referenced in each week's episode. So, yep, it goes all over the place, but it has some purpose, it has some sense, and I'm glad you're enjoying them. And yeah, every week, it's going to be different.
Yeah, and you can tell it's a passion project. So very cool on that.
Thank you.
And now let's get into the rest of our chat with Greg Fiddleman. Over to you, Steph.
I got to ask you about Johnny Cash. Mm-hmm. And I got to ask you about Johnny Cash and James Hetfield as two figures that you've worked with. I mean, just give us your thoughts on how they are. They're both such amazing presences.
Right.
So, I mean, what did you learn or what have you learned from each of them that's been significant? Do they have similarities? I mean, do you ever wonder? I mean, I always think of James as being in that pantheon of personality. Mm. He's got that presence, that gravitas. So,
Yeah, he has that presence that, very different. And my experience with him was obviously working with Johnny. I don't know how old Johnny was when I first worked with him. That would have been 95 or 6 maybe. And he, an older, very grateful gentleman vibe, but still just like the legend part of it. I suppose part of that's the person that's the legend and also the person that's approaching the legend, what they have in their head. So for me, you know, and most people probably, you know, working with Johnny Cash was insane. It was completely fairy tale stuff. So I was a little, you know, you're a little apprehensive. And also this is early on in my career of doing this kind of stuff. But, you know, when I heard, you know, when John, again, between takes or something, you know, John, he said, hey, Greg, can you bring me another cup of tea? You know, when I heard that over the speakers in the control room, it was definitely like, whoa, okay.
Was it an existential moment? It's like someone is asking, Johnny's asking someone to bring a cup of tea.
Oh, wait.
Oh, it's me. Yeah, yeah. No, it's like, you know, you knew my name or whatever, yeah. But, you know, I was like doing, I was this, there was two assistants on that gig. It was a pretty nutty, it was like Johnny Cash with like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers was like the band. It was,
wow.
It was insane.
Wow.
So literally, I mean, Tom and Mike and Ben, the whole thing, you know, Johnny's in the booth and I'm like in charge of headphone mixing or something, which was an insane, because here's, you know, Tom's mix, this is Johnny's mix, this is Mike's mix, and you know, I'm the guy that's trying to keep everybody happy. So it's kind of a hectic, really fun, crazy gig. But yeah,
I wanted to dig in a little bit to your space, your area that you're working in the control room, because there's a board in there that is legendary. And we did a walkthrough and we do a little recording. But can you tell us a little bit about the boards that you're working with in that room?
Right. So, yeah, the control room here, it's a pretty insane dreamscape for someone like myself. There's an old Neve. We call it a sidecar, which it isn't really a sidecar. A sidecar is more like almost like a portable kind of console. This is really a part of a console, the main part of a console that used to be at Abbey Road. I believe like Wish You Were Here was recorded on it and whatever other records were in there at that time. It's post Beatles, but definitely early 70s. And that is oddly not unlike the console at Sound City that I sort of really cut my teeth on.
Oh.
That's like my go-to sounding console for sure. And the way we use it here, it's basically the meat and potatoes of the drum and guitar sounds come off of that console.
Okay.
And then SSL console, the big console that's in the front, the main console, is we use for some more auxiliary type stuff, and we mix on the big console. But one thing that's unique about HQ is we're always set up to make a record pretty much here, even though that's not what we're always doing, but we also are always set up for a tour rehearsal. And the tour rehearsals and recording a record, that is not the same setup. So in most studios, there would be a huge teardown and setup and back and forth and back and forth. But what we've decided to do here is to sort of have both of those things kind of always ready to go as much as they can be. So that's why there's so much stuff in there. Is I've got a tour recording setup basically so that they can come in here and do tour stuff. And then what they hear in their in-ears is what they would kind of hear on the road. And, you know, the guitar players are playing on their tour rigs and Rob as well. And then, you know, in 2 hours, me and Sarah can go in the control room and flip things around here and like, okay, let's
record a record,
record a song. And then he's on the studio rig, guitar rig, and Rob's on the studio bass rig.
That's great.
And we switch what mics we're recording for the drums. So there's just a lot of stuff that sort of always stays set up.
And that was a question that some fans, you know, we take these Spotify questions from fans and they wanted to know how ready is HQ for when the guys come in, and it's pretty much always at the ready.
It's pretty much always at the ready. I mean, there's always little funny things. Like recently, I had the tour sound guys in here. They're trying to switch some mics out that they use for tour. So we did a bunch of testing here on the tour set with different microphones and stuff. So when we did that, we had to change a few things. But for the most part, you know, in a few hours, we'll have it back up to whatever it is we want to do, whether it's a tour rehearsal or, you know, try to make a record.
I got to bring you back to probably the only other artist that I know of who's recorded in this building, the Metallica.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of want to get your feedback. I'm talking about Lou Reed.
Oh, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And those sessions, which, I mean, we were talking earlier about Johnny Cash and we're talking about James and we're talking about that energy and that aura. I think it's, I think we both agree that Lou had that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, am I right? I mean, he is the only other non-Metallica artist who's recorded in this building, right?
That's as far as I know,
As far as I know. So maybe if you would, I mean, I think people are somewhat aware of how Metallica record.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, definitely from the 90s. It was long, you know, a lot of assembly work, so on and so forth. Do you think that the work with Lulu, I know not everyone's favorite record, but
it is one of my... I
love it. I'm with you.
I love it.
No, no, I'm with you. And I, by the way, I think The View is one of the lost riffs of Metallica's recent history. I think it's brutal. Yeah. That riff is just so heavy.
Yeah.
So, but talk us through, from your perspective, what it was like to do those sessions, and also whether you believe that the band came away doing anything different as a result of how Lou worked when he was here.
Yeah, where would I start? You know, those sessions were, when we started that, that's a long time ago now, we didn't really know what to expect. And you know Lars well enough to know that that was making him crazy. Not knowing what's going to happen is not allowed normally. But so we kind of just like, what are we going to do? How are we going to do it? Oh, we're going to set up. I mean, obviously we don't even know what the songs are yet. So we're going to have to rehearse. So we're sort of set up for a rehearsal. And Lou's got his setup. We're trying to figure out how to get him going. And he just wants to sing right here in the room, sitting kind of like where Kirk usually sits. And they just started doing some stuff and they started kind of jamming, I guess you would call it. And then let's go in the control room and listen back to that. And they went in the control room. This is like day one, I think. And Lou's like, that's amazing. That's awesome. That's it. All right. Let's do the next song. And Lars is like, what? Like, what?
See, I remember.
What are you talking about?
I remember that so
clearly. I don't even know what I did. Like, and that's how all that stuff sort of came to be. And it was all about just experimenting and just kind of jamming and really not thinking about it. Not, you know, no pre-thought, all very instinctual. And,
which is antithetical to this band at that point.
Well, yeah, so was that good for them, do you think?
It was very good for them. I think they learned to enjoy it.
Yeah.
It was a tricky process the whole way. And, you know, Lou was a super intense guy. Like some of the things that Lou said or yelled out, like while we were doing stuff, these things are still going. I don't know how long, that's a long time ago now, huh? I remember at one point, like Kirk was doing something on... This literally still is in our lexicon. Kirk was doing something kind of like Middle Eastern-y, kind of weird. I don't know if he had the wah on or whatever, or the phase shifter, whatever. It was very Middle Eastern. And like Lou just stops. He goes, no belly dancing shit. And we were just like, what? Oh my God, that's amazing. Anytime someone does something that's got like, you know, like no belly dancing shit.
I remember one time you guys were trying to get him to do something, another vocal in the studio, and he's like, I'm not doing it again.
Yeah.
I've done it.
There was a couple of those moments. There was definitely, no, that's it. Like, what do you mean that's it? Like, we can't even fix a guitar. Why would you fix it? It's perfect.
So when you're in that moment, and we talk about the emotional side again, mm-hmm. and being in touch with the emotions. You're in touch with our guys. I mean, you know them. You know how uncomfortable they kind of are feeling their way through this process. Like, you know, it's like you're in a sort of an escape house or something and the lights mm-hmm. are out and you're feeling your way. And then you've got Lou, who I think it's fair to say politely set in his ways.
Mm-hmm.
How did you, I mean, I can't remember how you managed that situation, but you managed it. But what's going through your head? I mean, are you thinking, shit, how do I? I've got to look after my guys. I've mm-hmm. got to deal with him. Did any of the experience with, I mean, I know Johnny Cash is very pleasant, but the Cashes and learning the Hetfields, did it come together at these moments and you're like, I know how to do this? Or are you like, shit, I don't know what to do?
Yeah, I don't think I ever, you know, it was a very new experience for everybody, but I definitely had, like, I knew what the way out is through. And mm-hmm. we're got to get through and let's get, you know, him. Hey, if Lou Reed says it's perfect, okay, and we don't think it's perfect, then either we are not understanding something that he likes or he's not understanding something that we don't like. But no matter which one of those things is, that's a conversation we can have tomorrow. So, okay, he thinks it's great. Hey, look, if we want to change it, we could change it tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But to get into it right now, that's not going to be helpful for anybody at all, especially in the big picture. So
that sounds like experience speaking to me.
Right, right. Yeah. So trying to navigate. Lou had Wilner, who was amazing. Hal was sort of Lou's guy, and I was kind of the Metallica guy. And Hal was also very good at this and just kind of, you go with it, you know. You're on a raft, you're in the rapids. You don't need an oar, mm-hmm. you know, it's not going to help.
Yeah.
Don't try to steer it. You got to go with it, get through. And I think quickly, it's a pretty quick project too. We pretty quickly kind of understood to trust each other, and me and Hal got.
Hello, Pantheon podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out, because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once, new quick charge function, three customizable sound styles plus awareness mode, available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
Along very well.
Okay, Greg, let's continue.
I know that Lulu is not, you know, it's not a favored record, quote unquote. And I feel that maybe we're all in agreement with this, that it's an album that one day a whole bunch of people are going to wake up and say, wow, it's actually very fucking cool. I mean, I think that. Yeah. But can you address this? I mean, Lars would probably say this is a, you know, 1, 2, 3 question, but I think a lot of people don't put these gaps together, spaces together.
So right, right.
Do you think that Hardwired could have happened without Lulu? Because, I mean, I think to the title track, which was just like, got to do it quickly. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I can't remember a time that this band could have done anything like that. Do you think the Lulu experiences fortified them to be able to do that?
Yes, and maybe some indirect ways as well. Definitely the Lou Reed project installed some confidence on them towards me. Mm. That for sure happened. And I don't know that the Hardwired project would have happened the way it did anyways, if they didn't have that confidence that they built during the Lulu record. And then keep moving forward as we get towards the end of the Hardwired thing, where we record that song, their confidence in me is solidified. But well, before that, probably, but it wasn't, you didn't need to talk about it anymore. You know what I mean? The key to the confidence thing is, it also, there's a lot of conversations you don't need to have because right. There's not a lot of questions, right? Yeah. It's, you just know, yeah, Greg thinks we could do this. I think we could do this. I mean, what else is there? You know, yeah. As far as they're concerned, what else is there? Of course we could do this.
Yeah.
Yeah. So definitely helped.
Let's shine a little light on the team that works with you. Mm. I mean, let's talk about Sarah, and I'm sure you want to talk about Jim too, but, you know, I mean, Sarah, of course, I think of you, I think of Sarah.
Right, yeah.
So talk a little bit about how you and Sarah work together, and that's Sarah, for people that don't know, Sarah Killian, engineer, co-pilot. I mean, I don't know, but there's so many, these titles, there's so many that people can
right.
have, right?
So, yeah. I mean, the first thing that I ever did with Sarah was Death Magnetic. And I sort of had known her a little bit from some of the studios in LA. We were into a situation where originally we were supposed to do all of Death Magnetic in Los Angeles. And it came to a point to where, I don't know if things were going slower than we were anticipating or whatever, but the guys really felt like they wanted to do some of this stuff up at HQ. And, you know, Rick talked to me about it. It's like, yeah, you know, he's like, I'm not going to San Francisco to do it. So it'll be you. And at that time, HQ, although it was a studio, and obviously they did St. Anger here, but it, after St. Anger was done here, it wasn't really, it was a rehearsal place that had a really, you know, cool console, but it wasn't like what it is now, where it's like, you know, you know, maintained or at least looked after. So the idea of coming up here was like, okay, who's, I don't know that room at all. I don't know anything about it. Who's going to help? I mean, there's not really anybody. And then this is how Kent Mackey kind of, I think, comes into the situation. Oh, there's a guy named Kent that worked on the Load Records or something like this, right? Like, I think he's, you know, maybe we can see if he wants to come in. So Kent comes in at that same time too. And I was like, I can't do, especially with these guys, you know, things got to move quick. I need someone to help taking notes because I can't take notes right. And do this and do that and do this. So just had an idea. Like, hey, what about Sarah? You know, she needs a break. And I don't even remember how I got Sarah's phone number. I don't even remember. But she was like, yeah, sure. And of course, you know, maybe she can attest to this. I think she's in here somewhere. But it's like, it probably was like, hey, you know, like two months, you know.
Quick little thing.
Come up to help take notes. And she, you know, she's, you know, incredibly organized and which was a really document stuff impeccably, which at the time I sort of knew, but not to the extent that I know now, is very helpful when you're working with these guys, especially with Lars. What did I say 20 minutes? You know, like, what was the thing that they did? You know, and she's like, oh, it's at this, it's at, you know, 20 minutes and 30 seconds into that record, you know, whatever.
Incredible. So,
so it just sort of really worked. Now, I don't remember how much longer we worked after that, but it was not 2 months. And then we started going to, we were like splitting weeks or something. I try to forget this, but like we would do like 3 days a week at HQ and like 2 days a week in Malibu, like doing vocals with James and Rick. So me and her were back and forth. It was pretty brutal. Yeah. And that went on for a while. And then sort of what happened when Death Magnetic was finally done, was it Slayer? Okay. Yeah. It was kind of like, well, I need help. And then it obviously worked well. What she was able to bring to the production was very helpful for me. So like, hey, I don't know that I've done a project since then that Sarah hasn't been involved with. And now, you know, like, Stefan said, you know, sort of if the guys, hey, where's Sarah? Like, oh, she's not coming. You know, they would be like, what? You know, I'd be like, whoa, hold on a second.
Yeah.
And then, like you said, Jim, our other engineer here, who did work, Jim worked on Death Magnetic. I don't know if Jim worked on much of the Hardwired record. He was on other projects, but I mean, I've known Jim forever. And he was here, very much integral part of the 72 Seasons record. And he will be upset that we're even saying his name because he is like the allergic to any attention.
Jim Monty is allergic to any attention.
Phone number 320.
So Jim Monty. We shouldn't say Jim Monty's name.
No,
certainly not three or
not
four times
the
in a row.
No.
Okay, all right. So make a note, guys. Yeah. Cut Jim Monty's name out.
Yeah.
That's Jim Monty.
Yeah. And he's, you know, he's an incredibly talented engineer, and he could pick up a guitar, he could play the riffs, he's very in tune with what's going on, and he understands all the language and all the ins and outs, and he's really good with drums. Lars really enjoyed working with him as well, so now he's stuck.
But he's happy to be stuck.
Oh, yeah, very.
He's happy.
Definitely, yeah.
All right, let's make this the final point before we conclude. And I do think it's an important project to talk about. It's S&M2. I think it's a fascinating project to talk about for obvious reasons. Not only, forget about producing the actual end product.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole product that had to be produced.
Right.
And you were an intrinsic part of that. So in a sense, I see this as maybe the bridge moment where you really became the fifth member in terms of the band. See, okay, we need him to help us shape our sound. We need him to do this, and you know, which we've seen you on the tour.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen you on M72 on and off doing that. But I feel it might have started here.
Mm-hmm.
And talk, if you will, about what it's like. How does it work? You have to work with the band. Mm-hmm. You have to work with Edwin Outwater from the SF Symphony.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much Michael Tilson Thomas was involved at that moment.
Right.
But you're working. So just bring us through that process? Because again, it's a genesis point for you in your right. career with this band, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it starts literally with like Lars calling me like, hey, we're thinking about, we might do another S&M kind of thing. And, you know, I know you're in the middle of another project, but you know, I'm trying to figure out like what songs from the original S&M project are ones that we would for sure want to carry forward. This is literally how it started. And which ones we think maybe aren't as important because we're going to want to bring in at least, you know, X number of new songs to the format. And I'm like, well, I'm in the middle of another, I'm really busy. Okay, well, Are you probably got Sundays off or something? Like, why don't you sit down with your wife Sativa, you know, and, you know, pour a glass of wine and sit down and listen to it. This is literally.
I can hear the conversation.
Yeah, I would love to do that. Sounds great. I would love to on my one day off. I would love to sit down and listen to S&M with my wife. I can't think of anything, and she's gonna like it too. So I did some of that, but most of it I did once I had time. But, you know, so it went from like literally then having conversations with him about this, I think this, and this, and this is why, and I think these no sense, and, you know, we don't need this, we don't need that. I don't know who's picking the new songs that we're going to try to do, but here's a list of, you know, the 10 that in my head might be interesting to come into the format. I mean, we didn't have any disagreement. I think we agreed almost entirely on that stuff.
And that's where you made your big mistake.
Right, yeah. And it was mostly, like you said, it was mostly with Edwin. I think Michael Tilson Thomas I didn't interact with him until we were right on to the almost like rehearsal time.
In the Chase Center itself.
But then, you know, meeting Edwin. And so the first process was like, we picked the songs and then we're like, all right, there's this arranger and he's going to do some mock-ups. And then I'll send it. They were on the road at the time and I was sending them stuff. And this is one of those moments in life where you're like, by chance or by whatever, I have a little bit of sort of proper, for lack of a better term, music training. So I could look, you know, James and Lars look at a piece of sheet music and they don't know, you know, forget it. I could look at a score and I could follow it and I can, you know, I'm not saying I can read well, but well enough to be able to have conversations with Edwin and to talk about what's good and what's not and how are you counting this and all that stuff. Trying to explain to him how they count it, which was fun because they have their own way of doing stuff. And I sort of always know and like, this is going to be, they're not going to like when he says that's 4 bars and they think it's 12. It's not going to go over well. But Edwin was awesome in that when I would say like, this is our language. Okay, no problem. And it was just like, okay, so, you know, when you say something to me, you could say this or that. But when you want to talk to them about it, make sure you don't use the language of the, you know, of the string section.
Right.
Because they'll look at you like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, what are you talking about? So
interesting.
That was super cool and very fun for me because it was really outside of what I normally have to deal with. And, it, you know, it's fun. And interesting. So, yeah, putting it together with them, getting the guys to agree on arrangements was interesting and fun. And then the insane aspect of rehearsing with the orchestra was nuts. And then trying to figure out the conduct, you know, Edwin is going to conduct and here's how Lars does his thing. So they had a lot of conversations about how to communicate. Yeah, it was really that's a really different kind of a project to be involved with. Very cool. And then getting into, I remember trying to, you know, the orchestra stuff is always very union based. There's a lot of rules that we're not used to. So we're like going to these rehearsals. I'm like, yeah, we got to record the rehearsal so I can review. No, you can't record the orchestra without paying a recording fee or whatever it is. Oh, okay. How am I going to do what I need to do if I don't get to listen back to it? That's literally what I do. It's like, yeah, you're a race car driver. You're going to have to do this one without a car, you know, or whatever, right? It's like, whoa, okay, I have to rethink this. So it was pretty hairy in that way. Well, we got through it and we had enough rehearsals and we were very, very organized going into that. And I think it worked out really well.
Really well.
Yeah. It did.
Beautiful record.
We're going to wrap up really soon, but I do have to ask you this. I think it's very clear that, and I think everyone knows, that Lars is brilliant. I mean, he's got a brilliant brain in so many ways and so many perspectives of this band. In many ways, he's producing the record before you've produced it, I think sometimes. And we've talked about that trust dynamic, and we've talked about how that's evened out and evened out and evened out. At this point in your relationship with him, which is obviously very important, you know, you give him pushback. I mean, you'll push back against him, right? I mean, and he'll take it. Am I right in saying that? He'll acquiesce.
Yeah. Definitely.
Do you think that's why you're on tour these days as well? Because he kind of needs that trusted audio voice?
Trusted. I don't think he's looking forward to pushback, but but he's got this tour is challenging in its own crazy little way, especially for him with the four drum sets. Mm-hmm. We knew going into this that was going to be a bit hairy. We had no idea how hairy it was going to be, and he didn't either. So once we did a few shows, and we're like, this is really, really tricky, and I wish this was better and that was better, and how can we get this better? And then he just wants me. Sarah was out there as well. It's the people that he is, you know, the live guys are amazing at what they do, but they're, when it gets into this sort of, what's the word, like, you know, really get into the tiny little aspects of, you know, I wish this cymbal was the same as, I wish the height of the snare drum was the same on every drum set down to the 16th of an inch. Like that sort of crazy micro stuff is stuff that me and Sarah do every day when we're working on a record. That's what it's all about, little, like really finessing everything.
Right.
And the live thing is much more like, go, 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 you know, bam. So we sort of went in there to sort of help crack the code on sort of some of those things and what could we do differently. And we worked with the live guys. How do you do this? And why do you do, is there a different way you could do it? Is there a reason why we can't change this? That sort of stuff. So
incredible. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely, he's not sounded better live.
No.
He's playing, great.
He's playing amazingly.
Yeah. And he's been
so good.
Yeah, I don't practicing, I guess that's the word. He's doing that. No one's asking him to do it. You know, he's doing it himself. I think he's mentioned this to me. I'm not making that up. The fact that he is the age that he is, obviously this doesn't get easier, right? That sort of, I think, has inspired him to work on it harder because it's not so automatic anymore.
Right. Well, he's doubling down on the fuck you of age.
Totally.
I mean, that's his fuck you.
Yeah.
That's the kid that was a fuck you kid.
Yeah. Right.
This is his fuck
this
you.
This is the adult fuck you.
Right. This is the adult fuck you to age. No, it is. And like everything that he does, he's doing it all out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's getting it done.
Yeah.
And it's working. It's fascinating. And it's tremendous that you're part of a very, very vital part of that journey, I would say. I think before we go, we should probably congratulate you on the Grammy.
Thank you.
Come on. Bravo. I think that's really good. How did that, let's leave the final words on that. How did that feel?
I mean, it feels good. You don't do this stuff to get that stuff, but it's nice. It's nice. And then, you know, it's nice to know people are into it, and you know, you get some emails from people you don't expect, or sometimes even people that you don't really know very well saying, you know, how awesome they thought it was. And so it's really great in that way. I wish that the genre of rock could be a bigger part of the televised thing, but I also understand why it isn't.
Yeah.
And I there's nothing in the televised a version of the Grammys that I think should be nixed. So I totally, you know, it's all important. And I understand, you know, rock, especially heavy rock, is not in the forefront of some of these other kinds of music, which is fine. I like all different kinds of music myself. So like I said, it'd be nice if it were a little bit more part of the big show, but I understand why it isn't.
Do they physically give you one? Do you have a Grammy? Do they physically give you a
No.
One? You don't physically get one?
No. Not for that award. No,
not for that one. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. But we know that you are a major part of that Grammy. So anyway, thank you so much for
your
time.
You're very welcome. That was fun.
I mean, incredible, right?
No, incredible. This is like more than I could ask for. No, just hanging out with Greg Fiddleman.
Right. I do. And look, the deep base of knowledge you have.
Yeah.
And I think also, and I think many a fan would agree, but I think that not just the knowledge, but I think the empathy that you have with them has been just so critical to everything that has happened from Death Magnetic on.
Ooh,
so I'm sure I speak for all the fans when I say thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Right. No, all right.
Great work.
All right, guys.
Have a good one.
All right.
See ya.
All right.
Bye, Greg.
And let me just say, I think Lulu will one day be revered. I honestly do. And let the debates begin, right?
Yeah. I think you're going to have a few people who want to argue that point. And to that, I'm going to say, if you think Steph is full of it, get in touch with us. Let us know. Seriously, though, we are interested in your thoughts on Lulu, especially after hearing Greg talk about its significance and how it plays in subsequent Metallica records. So what we ask you to do is check the Spotify Q&A to weigh in. Once again, thanks very, very much indeed to Greg. It was so much fun and so insightful, and I could just listen to him talk about his work for days. And as a special treat, go to Metallica's YouTube channel because you're going to be able to see video of the entire Greg conversation.
Yeah, and it has indeed been a great couple of pods here, and it was a great conversation. He sure is eloquent, isn't he?
Yep.
I mean, he really is, and there's so many more stories to tell. We just scratched the surface. But hey, next week, who knows what sort of shenanigans are going to go down. One thing we do know is you better make sure you're here to catch them.
That's right.
So thank you, and
see ya. Right away.
The Metallica Report is produced by Metallica HQ, Pantheon Media, and Pop Cult.
If you like what we're doing here, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Be sure to visit Metallica.com/podcast to submit your questions, offer your thoughts, and become a part of this podcast.
Copyright 2023, all rights reserved.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.